You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where the only white hat any of us wears celebrates our true Lord and Savior, Bill Belichick. Which I think you'll find if you do a little bit of research that Tom Brady said something to that effect this week. In our super secret Welcome to the Midside Facebook message thread this week, I shared a quote from the Pope that I found particularly terrifying. Though during his visit to the United States, the Catholic leader advocated many bizarre, seemingly non-religious positions such as stopping climate change, none of his statements were as insane as this one. I quote, "A good political leader is one who, with the interest of all in mind, seizes the moment in a spirit of openness and pragmatism." Packed in that one sentence is no less than three irrational philosophical positions. With the interest of all in mind is collectivism, seizes the moment is opportunism, and pragmatism is, well, pragmatism. If these are the ideas being advocated by the man whom many consider to be their moral leader, and the man whom we in America stop our lives for when he visits, is it any wonder that the world and our country are the way they are? I want to say that this circus dominating the news cycle is better than constantly hearing about the latest social justice warrior cause, but really, is there any difference? Joining me this week, via Skype, from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards. Daniel, which was a bigger disruption of life in D.C., the Pope or the release of the iPhone 6S?
Oh, definitely the iPhone. 100%. Certainly disrupted my life more. I only have nice things to say about the Pope when he comes to town, because that means I can work from home.
Which means yes. You can get out of work earlier and go get your iPhone when you have your appointment.
Maybe. Yes. So the Pope, in terms of traffic disruption and life disruption, was very minimal because all the federal workers worked from home, and anyone basically who wanted to could work from home. So when I was actually driving around in the city, it was the best traffic I'd ever seen. It was fantastic. It was sort of like Carpocalypse in LA, where they said, everyone stay home, 405 is being closed down. And so the people who did go out experienced the best traffic of their life.
Also joining us via Skype from the House of Mouse, Elliot Rivera. Elliot, news this week came out what they're going to be closing at Disneyland when they put in Star Wars Land. So this is the question I have to ask you. Do I need to check out Big Thunder Ranch before it closes for good?
Yes. Whether it closes or not, you need to go check it out.
Well, it is closing for good. That's what they're going to do when they put in Star Wars Land. That's one of the things they're getting rid of. So why do I need to check it out?
Because it's Disney. And anything Disney does, you need to check
So everything
because Disney.
Everything in the park is good.
No, I mean, it's because, I mean, you know how I am. I love anything to do with the parks. You know, I love the Disney company. It's provided my paycheck, and it's been very good to me and my family and to the city that I was born and raised in. So anything that the parks, you know, any changes that are coming, I'm looking forward to seeing. But yeah, definitely check it out. You should check it out just because it's worth checking out.
Wait, is Big Thunder Park the same as Big Thunder Railroad?
No. Big Thunder Ranch is like, they have like, I guess, shows there, and there's like a restaurant there and everything.
Oh.
So I might eat there because I'll never be able to eat there again. But I do disagree with the premise that everything in Disney is worthwhile. I went on the Little Mermaid ride recently, and I was very disappointed. Because at the end, they didn't show Ursula getting killed. Yeah. And I was like, they pussified this ride.
I know. They didn't do that the best way. But it's worth doing. Anything in Disney is worth doing once. If for no other reason than because millions of people in the world will never get to do it.
Were you on the Little Mermaid ride just surrounded in a sea of four-year-old girls?
That's pretty much what Disney is whenever you're there. It's just a sea of four-year-olds, and you're like, why are parents paying for this? These kids are never going to remember this.
You and a bunch of parents staring at you? what it was.
No, they're too distracted by trying to keep their kids under control and trying to pretend they're not angry for being there because they're wasting all their money and they know they're wasting their money.
Now, when you guys come down to Walt Disney World, you know, here in Orlando, I think you're going to be much more at home, particularly in parks like Epcot, which are a little bit more adult. There's a little more stuff going on. I think you'll enjoy that a lot more.
Yeah, the thing I really liked about Disneyland California Adventure was beer.
Oh, wait till you get to Epcot.
Not the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror, it was the beer.
Well, I've been on the better Tower of Terror in Disney World.
Oh, it's better in Disney World?
It's better. It's way better.
All right, I'm moving to Orlando.
Orlando!
And we're moving on to the news with Daniel P. Richards.
It really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad. 'Cause kid, there's consequences to what we say and what we do. While you're dancing like an idiot, they're looking up to you.
The internet exploded this week again, not because of the Pope, though he was on the internet. No, because of hedge fund bro.
I think the Pope being on the internet and using it would be hilarious. Why has nobody done like a video of this before?
He has a Twitter account, although I'm convinced he doesn't actually run the Twitter account, but it's at Pontifex.
Do any of these politicians or celebrities really run their Twitter accounts?
I think Anthony Weiner did, yeah. He may have been the last one. Uh-huh. Yeah, then they got out of the business. Anyway, no, hedge fund bro, who is later known as pharma bro, the guy who raised an AIDS drug from $13.50 a pill to $750 a pill, the scum of the earth, the example of what is bad and evil about capitalism, all that is wrong with the world, this 23-year-old millionaire who decided to make a buck off of AIDS-ridden gays. In fact, he is a former hedge fund manager who purchased the rights to a drug that treats parasitic infections, namely toxoplasmosis. The drug has been around for 62 years and was originally priced, like I said, at $13.50. He raised it more than 5,000%, and he's now public enemy number one. I'm sure you guys heard about this.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, this guy, disgusting evil bastard, or just simply low-life evil scum?
Well, can we talk about the fact that so many, like, libertarians who should know better are using this as an example are using this as an excuse to attack the concept of property rights, particularly patents? Can we talk about that for a minute? I mean, that's...
Okay.
I mean, you're talking about it, so...
I mean, literally talk about it, but you know, I just want to bring up that point. Like, okay, if you want to defend free markets and defend capitalism and property rights, that includes intellectual property. And that has to include things like patents and copyrights. I mean, wouldn't you agree?
I mean, I definitely agree. And our lovely audience at Libri.me may slightly disagree with us on this point to some degree. But I think you're exactly right. This is an example of an area where there is not enough free markets, not too much free markets, and if there was a better market for competition in the healthcare field, this kind of thing wouldn't happen. But that being said, this kind of thing is not really happening. This is a non-story story, as so many of the stories are that we decide to cover in news. First of all, the drug is 62 years old. A generic can be created, and in fact, the hedge fund guy, Martin Shkreli, sounds like a douche name, went on TV and said we would welcome a generic to enter into the market so that everything is made better. People who have the generic can afford it and have it, and people who want the brand name drug can have it as well.
So is this guy secretly a genius and he's doing this to try and make a point about more people need to be proactive in creating generic drugs and generic products?
I am starting to believe it was purely a marketing stunt, yes.
Well, yeah, because he said he's going to lower the price back, didn't he? Not down to $13.50, but he's going to make it much more reasonable.
The price is going back. But again, another aspect of this that was not reported is not a single actual human being who needs this drug will pay $750 a pill for this drug. Not one. Zero human beings.
Is it only the insurance companies?
Insurance companies will pay that amount of money for the drug. Yes. And he went on TV and said, we've already set up a program for if anyone who doesn't have insurance and who can't afford this drug, we will give it to them for $1 a pill. $1 a pill.
Well, how many pills do they have to take? Do they have to take 750 pills?
I don't think so. But even if it was, it would be cheaper than the $13.50 it was previously offered. And anyone who can't afford the dollar a pill, they have a program where you can apply to get it for free. Now, not they can't do that for everyone, but it exists. This is an example of the healthcare market being insanely regulated and businesses taking advantage of that because that's the only way they can make a legitimate amount of money.
Yeah, but you just convinced me that this guy's a secret genius.
I don't know. It's not so secret. He's a 32-year-old millionaire former hedge fund manager. He's pretty much a fucking genius.
But what I mean by that is this is one of those times where someone's doing something, and I shudder to make this comparison, but it's like the way Bill Belichick trolls the media. And what I mean by that is you kind of have me convinced that he's trolling everyone to make a point, and everyone's too stupid to understand the point. Like, it seems like he did this to make fun of healthcare. And to show people how absurd healthcare is.
I don't think so. I don't think so. I don't think he's intentionally trolling anybody.
I don't know. I'm not convinced that he legitimately was going to raise the price on this all along.
Yeah, but if he's that smart and he owns this company, he has to know that if he raises it to $750, people aren't going to be paying it. Only the insurance companies are going to be paying it. And then he also has to know that the media is going to jump on this and go after him in the way it has. So either he's incredibly naive or he is a genius. Do you see what I'm saying? As the two choices, like there's no in between. Because he's either naive and thinks that the media weren't going to touch him and all of a sudden he's like, oh no, the media's after me. Or he knew they were going to touch him and he knew this was going to become a story.
Well, he probably expected maybe a story, but he probably didn't think it was going to catch fire the way it did. I mean, I don't know.
I don't know.
Neither did Katniss, Elliot. Neither did Katniss.
Thank you.
But the other interesting thing about this story is that people don't bring up the fact that even when the drug was priced at $13.50, the company that produced those, that had made these drugs, they were operating at a loss. So they were losing money at that price. That's the whole reason why he raised it. So
but
that they
AIDS,
could...
Elliot, AIDS. Couldn't you of all people have sympathy?
You of all
it's like
people.
That idiot. It's like that idiot that gave that so-called slap down to this guy who turned him down because he didn't want to be with somebody who was HIV positive, you know. And then the media treated the HIV positive guy as a hero for, you know, being really rude and unnecessarily rude
for being HIV positive
for telling somebody, you know, because. For being rude to this guy who essentially was just honest with him about it. That's all. So, I mean, I think that it's still one of those sacred cows that people really don't want to talk about. They you know, if you have HIV or if you have AIDS, then you are, you know, above reproach, or it's not something, you know, it's just taken for granted that any AIDS research or AIDS medication should be free, or the government should fund it, or, and people don't understand that it just doesn't work that way. I mean, it has to get paid for.
I just want to make a point about this sanctity of AIDS thing. Jared had AIDS.
Yes, he did. And Hillary has AIDS. Yes.
My question of this is, how many people actually were buying this drug? Because it seems to me like this is, again, part of this guy being a secret genius. It seems to me like this was an obscure drug.
So, yeah, to clarify, this is not like a wide AIDS treating drug. It is a drug that treats a really specific kind of infection that AIDS patients are prone to because of their immunodeficiency. I mean, we're talking hundreds of people here. We're not talking tens of thousands or millions of people.
Right. So even the media saying this drug is used to treat AIDS is incorrect. It's not an AIDS drug. It's sort of like you have AIDS and then this other thing happens to you because you have AIDS and it treats the other thing. It's like, yes. You stub your, or you break your toe, and then you get an infection, and you take a drug for the infection, and then you say it's a broken toe drug. No, it's not a broken toe drug. It's a drug to treat the infection which was caused by the broken toe.
Correct. And again, toxoplasmosis, I think, is the name for it. And it's a really, really specific, rare kind of infection, which is part of the reason this drug is expensive in the first place.
I wish right now that House was still on, because they would do a great episode about this. Where House would just mock everyone.
It's true.
Because so the guy who does the, what would happen in the episode is this guy who raised the money would get, who raised the cost, would get sick. And then Cameron would be really pissed off about it. And then House would mock both of him and Cameron.
True. And in the end, everyone would laugh and cry and it would be a great episode. Emmy Award winning. The one thing I didn't particularly like about this story, and maybe I should be over this by now because I'm an adult, is just the language people use to talk about this just was really infuriating to me. I mean, of course, Hillary Clinton threw out the term price gouging, which is ridiculous. And many people on Twitter called him evil, of course. And let's see, at Aardvark Wizard said, I'm not normally like, wow, I wish this person would die, but this AIDS drug hedge fund guy should probably fall into a pit of flaming garbage.
But you're also an Aardvark Wizard, so...
True. True. At Ordquailu, whatever. Hedge fund managers make a living charging people to gamble with their money, and now one of these fuckers is profiteering off sick people. Profiteering off sick people. Profiteering off sick... Do you think the sick people would prefer that this guy not be around or that he be around? Do you think that people who are dying would prefer that drug companies not have any incentive to make life-saving drugs, or would they prefer if they did have some incentive to make life-saving drugs?
Part of what he's objecting to with that profiteering comment is that this guy just bought the drug and then raised the price. Somebody put up a meme this week I saw of it said that this guy didn't invent it. And he raised the price, and then it pointed out that Jonas Salk released the polio vaccine for free. So that's what people are objecting to, that he didn't even invent this, and he's raising the price.
Yeah, there was a takedown of that meme that I don't remember exactly what it was, but you should Google it if you're interested in that kind of commentary, because there was a ton of stuff that was factually incorrect about that.
Wait, you mean a meme was wrong? It was sensationalistic and just said the basic things to seem cool.
The devil, you say. Really?
Yeah, I know, it's weird, but it's strange. So, but this is the thing. He bought this in order to make this company more profitable. If this company was less profitable, they would have less incentive to create new life-saving drugs, and they, in fact, may go out of business. The fact that they are more profitable means that they have more resources, more people, more time to create new, interesting, life-saving drugs for literally hundreds of people, not tens of millions. The drug that these people should be thanking God or their maker or science for
or
are being made by companies that have to make a lot of money because it takes a lot of time and resources to do this kind of thing. I don't know. This is one thing. So Adam Carolla reference, ready? Bald Brian on the Adam Carolla show, he's sort of like the sidekick. He is a leftist for the most part. But he also is living with a brain tumor, and a brain tumor that he was supposed to have basically a 0% chance of living
through. That's why he's a leftist then. Okay, got it.
But he got to try an experimental drug called Avastin, which later, by the way, the FDA said, oh, no, most people can't try this drug because it's too dangerous. And it saved his life.
Which is more dangerous, a brain tumor or a drug that could possibly stop the brain tumor?
Yep, there you go. There's the evil contradiction of the FDA. And... so now he's a leftist still, but he is an enormous supporter of Big Pharma. In fact, on the show, he often goes on these long rants about how Big Pharma should be bigger. They should get more money. We should pay more for this kind of stuff because it is a miracle. It is, if there is anything that demonstrates an actual miracle in reality, it is drug technology. A pill that can completely change your entire life through pharmacology. It's insane.
This is the last value thing we get. I'm going to say on this story, and it's in defense of Big Pharma. One of the biggest myths in our culture, one of the biggest conspiracy theories that I hate, is the idea that these Big Pharma companies have the cure to all these diseases, and they're hiding them and not releasing them to make more money off of treating the symptoms rather than curing the disease. As if somehow curing the disease would not make them fucking filthy rich gazillionaires.
Yeah, exactly. Well, speaking of filthy liberals, hippies, whatever you want to call them, Wesleyan University, I'm sure Justin is very familiar, a group of students and faculty members are petitioning to defund the Connecticut campus's newspaper, the Wesleyan Argus, because, quote, it neglects to provide a safe space for the voices of students of color. According to an article in the Argus, the protesting group has also pledged to boycott the newspaper until its demands are met. The demands are a safe space on the newspaper's front page devoted to submissions from minority voices. Also, positions should be created at the newspaper that count for course credit or work study. Okay, that seems reasonable. Like, that's sandwiched in the middle of this ridiculousness.
Like, and why isn't that already happening?
Diversity training should be provided to members of all campus publications. So as someone who was the editor of my paper and faced constant threats of being defunded over various opinions, these protesters can go fuck themselves with a stick.
Isn't college already diversity training? Like, do we need to be specific and say anyone involved with a college publication needs diversity training? I thought that's what the entire 4-year experience was.
Basically, yes. It's basically a mind-washing toward the leftist ideology, primarily this idea that diversity per se is a good thing, which I think is nonsense to begin with. Little known fact, there is a minority paper at Wesleyan. Was this widely reported anywhere? I don't think it was. But in fact, there is a paper that focuses specifically on minority voices. How many white writers do you think are on that staff? Zero. That's the answer.
So was this, was this a secret marketing push to have the minority paper become the front page of the major paper?
Advertising, marketing.
I don't know what it was. It's hard for me to tell what is a stunt anymore and what is people being serious about their retarded beliefs.
Well, here's something I'm going to say. I think the reason you can't tell the difference between that, and yes, obviously this is something I'm going to say because I'm saying it. Shut up, audience. But I think the reason you can't tell the difference is that we live in an age where everything is a stunt. Everything is done for attention from other people, so people have internalized that behavior to the point that they don't even realize they're doing it. That's just how they behave on a daily basis. From big things like this in the news to the way they interact on a daily basis. Everything is stunt.
Yeah. I think the disappointing thing for me in this article is that there were professors signing the petition to defund the paper, which is outrageous, and I think any professor who signed that petition should be immediately fired, and if there was no such horrible thing as tenure, they probably would. Because this is the thing, when I was in school, we had a newspaper editor who was just unbelievably leftist in her views, except she was old school leftist in her views, old school scientific communist kind of leftist in her views, which also meant that she believed free speech was the most important thing in the entire world. And so when I would write a libertarian or conservative-leaning editorial and staff would get in a huge uproar because I said that torture was a good thing, she would scream back in their faces, "Do you want me to shut him up? Do you think it's right that we just gag him? Should we literally tie him to the ground and not let him write?" She was really defensive about that, which I loved. So the professors here can also go fuck themselves with a bigger stick. One other thing being sort of not widely reported is that the Wesleyan's president, Michael S. Roth, published a message to the university basically saying, screw you. I actually like it a lot. He says, quote, "Debates can raise intense emotions, but that doesn't mean that we should demand ideological conformity because people are made uncomfortable. As members of a university community, we always have the right to respond with our own opinions, but there is no right not to be offended." Because it's mine. "We certainly have no right to harass people because they don't like our views. Censorship diminishes true diversity of thinking. Vigorous debate enlivens and instructs. Make this man president of the United States." That's what I say. What say you?
He probably has sex with kids or something.
We should try to, like, buy advertising on the paper. Like, let's place ads and just give them our money. Just so that even if they do wind up getting defunded, they have to have, like, advertising and that we could pay for so that we can keep the paper afloat.
All right, Elliot, you look into that. All right? Your assignment. I don't have fucking time to do that.
You know what this whole controversy started?
How did this controversy start?
There was an article that hinted at, not outright said, but hinted at that the Black Lives Matter may have sparked violence toward police officers.
May have?
How may have. Fucking controversial.
May have.
May have.
Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
Baltimore. I'm just saying, Baltimore. May have.
Baltimore's offensive in and of itself, but
on many levels.
Yeah.
Baltimore giving us the Ravens, the Wire, and police riots.
It also gives us John Waters and Hairspray, so.
Ugh. The most naturalistic city in America.
Somebody actually, speaking of that, I forget who it was. It may have been Katrina. But somebody actually pointed out to me that Baltimore is actually more naturalistic than it's portrayed on The Wire. Which, I find that hard to believe. Which kind of scares me.
I've told this story a bunch of times, but it's my favorite, which is, it clicked to me that it is the most naturalistic city in America because it has a sculpture commemorating the Holocaust, and the sculpture is a giant ball of fire with people sticking out of it burning to death.
I'm sorry, that's funny.
I wish I was making that up, but that is their statue commemorating the Holocaust. A literal reenactment of the Holocaust. Yes. So anyway. Elliot, I have a question for you. Are you ready, Elliot?
I'm ready.
Okay. Does buying a rose gold iPhone 6S make you gay?
Make you gay? No. But but if you get one, if it's rose gold, you probably are gay. I don't think you're gay, but you probably are gay. If you
strong
get
indicator.
I have a question about iPhone color. While we're using this transition, and I do approve of the transition, but this is my question: does anyone actually look at the color of their iPhone? Doesn't everyone just immediately buy a case? Like when I just got my new one, I took the case off of the old one because I wasn't going to use it anymore, and I looked at it and I was like, "Oh yeah, that's what the back of my iPhone looks like," because the color is irrelevant to me. I never look at it.
I am one of the rare human beings who has never ever used an iPhone case. And I've also never dropped my phone.
What? How do you not drop your phone?
I've never dropped my phone.
It's like an eel.
What are you doing with your phone?
That's what she said.
I feel like you should have your phone and the KY in very different places.
Well, there's a reason masculinity is so fragile.
Yes, indeed. The question comes from an article by Dexter Thomas from the Los Angeles Times, titled, "Why is hashtag masculinity so fragile?" The question is basically about something Anthony Williams, a sociology major at UC Berkeley, started tweeting about this week when he tweeted with the hashtag masculinity so fragile in an effort to talk about violence and harassment that women face. We can't have a talk about men unless we're using that as some way of talking about women, by the way.
Yeah, I love that. I love the fact that this is about like trying to understand masculinity and somehow it's about violence against women. Like, why are men only defined in relation to women? What if we did that to women? If we said women were only defined in relation to men, how much of an uproar would there be?
There'd probably be a rioting in Baltimore, at least. So, Williams, the sociology student, when he was using this hashtag, woke up to death threats. And that's, of course, what started the article, because if you want any excuse to write an article about anything you want, you can just say you got death threats on Twitter. And
can we just
news.
Let go of the idea of death threats on the internet? Like, they're not real death threats. There are anonymous people who hide behind their anonymity and say ridiculous shit that they don't really mean. These people who are saying these things on Twitter could not make good on a death threat if they actually made one.
I mean, yes. If we're going to talk about death threats, let's at least, you know, go old school, you know, a bloody horse's head in the bed. You know, a dead fish wrapped the newspaper on the doorstep, you know.
As an Italian-American, I find these statements offensive.
No, look, listen, if you're going to make death threats, let's do it properly. But hiding behind anonymous Twitter accounts, it's just cowardice. Come on.
Because to put a horse's head in someone's bed requires killing the horse, cutting the head off, carrying the head, sneaking into the house, and putting the head there and sneaking back out. It requires you to do something in reality. So if somebody does that and you see it when you wake up, you go, well, shit, they could have actually killed me. But instead they left the horse's head. But on Twitter, you're like, oh, good. Somebody was bored on their phone again.
I think most people would go, is this a movie reference? I think this is on Family Guy? I think this was on Family Guy. Anyway, so the article here in question is not about death threats, in fact, but about why men are so fragile. Williams quotes, when you challenge masculinity, it hits a nerve. It makes some men nervous, and then non sequitur. But violence against women is a result of the fragility of masculinity. A woman can say no to a man on a date, and she could end up dead.
Oh, stupid.
That's what women have to deal with, and we as men have to recognize that. By the way, everyone who has ever said no to me on a date has gotten a shovel to the face.
Yeah, point of order, I just want to say that is, I sent this article to Katrina, our resident anti-feminist expert, who she co-hosted last week when Daniel was gone, and her response to the article was, when was the last time a woman was killed for saying no to a date? You think, and this is my editorial now, you think that'd be a big news story, wouldn't it? Man kills woman because she rejected him. Like, wouldn't the social justice warriors eat that up?
Yeah, no, this is the thing, you'd hear about it all the time. This relates to any of the leftist causes, right? Like, Breitbart, for instance, offered $10,000 for any video footage of someone at, Obama's inauguration calling him the N-word or something like that? Because the left claimed it was all over, like it was all over the crowd. Breitbart said, okay, $10,000 for any video showing anyone doing it. And then he raised it to $100,000 because no one provided one, and to this day there is none.
And no one even tried to fabricate one, right?
Nope.
not a green screen, nothing of that?
Ridiculous.
And that's the thing, like, okay, I have an answer as to, based upon this example, as to why masculinity might be so fragile.
Mm-hmm.
It's because we have to be defensive about it. What do you think it's like, and this is a rhetorical question for the audience, not the other two guys on the podcast, but audience, what do you think it's like to be basically told that you are a violent creature who can't control himself? And what I mean by that is, when you hear a story that says women have to be afraid that if they reject a guy, that they're going to be killed by the guy or attacked by the guy. Well, how do you think that colors our interactions, my interactions with any woman? That means when I approach a woman, or I don't approach a woman now because of this bullshit, I have to keep in mind that she might be afraid of me. Not for two reasons. One, because I might kill her if she says no. So then if she even says yes, I have to question if she's actually interested in me or not, or just afraid of me. And then two, because my sexuality is considered violent too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe that's why we're so fucking fragile. Maybe that's why we like our goddamn football.
I don't think masculinity is being defined correctly by these people. You know, I mean, it's...
Well, that was basically my point.
I know. But I mean, this is basically my issue with this. Masculinity, I mean, we would never think to define femininity by means of, you know, fainting from the vapors in the parlor. Like, you know, or wearing dresses or anything. We wouldn't think of femininity in that way. There's a whole integrated concept of femininity and of masculinity that is completely being ignored in this debate. Because their view of femininity is weakness. The ones, you know, the people who need to be protected from the angry, aggressive, masculine men. You know, it's just completely false, this whole idea of equating masculinity with violence and aggression. And I think that that's something that needs to be addressed.
Well, I'm gonna say two things here. One, I think we should define femininity from now on as fainting from the vapors in the parlor.
It's so southern, isn't it? It's just definition.
It sounds like such a non sequitur, which is why I love it. But the second thing is, this goes back to a point, and I might have made this last episode, or it was in the recent episode, about the Psychology of Self-Esteem book by Nathaniel Brandon, where he talks about the biological roles of men and women during sex, based simply upon how the biology of it works. And that's what people are confusing. They're confusing the male role in it as aggressive and violent, and the female role as weak. As if, you know, accepting someone and wanting them is weak, and as if pursuing someone is violent and aggressive. And it's also, I would actually say it's a package deal on the word aggressive. Making that so aggressive necessarily means violence. You can be aggressive towards a woman because, you know, you're interested in her, so you're aggressive, you're proactive. without being violent. Those are not, aggressive and violent are not the same thing.
No, absolutely not. My favorite part of this story, aside from the ridiculousness, is the more ridiculousness. They interview a Palestinian guy named Dramali, who apparently was, he was told he had nice shoes, and then I'm assuming the word fag or something like that. It just says anti-gay slur, which they couldn't print, because he was wearing bright pink shoes when he was working out.
Well, point of order, and I think, before you continue the story, I just got the impression that this guy actually was gay. So I don't think they were calling him gay because of his shoes. I think they were calling him gay because he was gay, and they were using the shoes to make fun of the fact that he was gay. So I think the causality is reversed here, but continue.
Perhaps. So he was confused about this. He was Palestinian, grew up in Egypt. He says in Egypt, guys will hold hands with their best friend. It's not a big deal.
Gay.
But these are my favorite quotes from him, which are basically have nothing to do with the article, really. But they're really funny. He says, yeah, sometimes I wear pink shoes or wear cucumber melon deodorant. That doesn't make me any less of a man. It just means that I have ridiculous shoes and my armpits smell like a delicious salad sometimes.
Okay.
So, okay, that's hilarious. But the rest of the article goes on to make fun of these, like, man type of products, like Q-tips, for instance, that are labeled like the men's ultimate multi-tool, and they're just regular Q-tips. But be fucking fair in your journalism. There are women's products that are equally stupidly marketed, like a razor. Like, my fiance's razors are all goddamn pink with flowers on them. They're all fluffy and curvy, and they look like silk. It's a razor. You're cutting hair with it, okay? This goes both ways. It's just simply marketing. It's sometimes men want things that are, you know, steel and cars and whatever, and sometimes we want things that are soft and silky and flowery. What the fuck ever? This is nothing about masculinity and femininity as a culture. Stop being so fucking shallow about it.
Isn't she your fiance, Daniel?
Did I not say that?
Yeah, he's your fiance.
I thought you said girlfriend. I'm like,
He's my fiance. I heard the word fiance.
Give the tape back!
Don't get him in trouble yet. We've got the Reddit question that's going to get him in trouble.
All right.
So anyway, I think this entire article is insanely shallow and doesn't actually want to deal with any of the questions it actually raises. It simply wants to make fun of men, call them rapists, violent, serial killing fucks. So to Mr. What's-Your-Face, who wrote this article, Mr. Dexter Thomas, yeah, you're gay. Shut up.
Other things that are shallow include the new television season. We discuss it now in The Hopeful Romantic with JML. There was a crisis this week, or at least an agenda in the news, and we'll get to that in a second, but first we're going to review a few shows. I want to talk about real quickly the show Blindspot, the show The Player, and the show The Muppets. Woo. Now, out of you guys, I'm assuming neither of you have seen Blindspot or The Player.
Didn't know they existed.
Well, you know they existed because we did our thing a couple weeks ago where we went through the shows we were going to sample, and I mentioned both of them.
Wasn't listening.
You douchebag.
It's on the DVR. The Blindspot is anyway.
Okay. So, well, you might like Blindspot, Elliot, because it's a procedural, which I found super disappointing. Because I was like, hey, here's this interesting premise. And then it became a procedural.
Is it about Daredevil's dog?
That was a good joke. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you.
I wish I had written that joke, actually. That was good. All right. No, what it's about is, so it starts out very naturalistically, and the show is very naturalistic in general, which is ironic because we're going to get to something in a second here. But it starts out in Times Square, and there's this duffel bag in Times Square, and a cop comes over to it, and it says, call the FBI. And then it cuts to three FBI agents in some small town in or small house in Kentucky. I don't know why I assumed it was Kentucky, but it's because it was this really stereotypical Southern guy who kept his wives locked up. And this, the leader of the guy figures out a way to rescue the wives. Then it cuts back to FBI headquarters where this guy is flown to immediately, the guy who figured out how to rescue the wives, and his name is tattooed on this woman who was inside of the duffel bag. The whole episode is about figuring out that the tattoos are clues to things that are going to happen, and as they solve the crime with the clue, this woman starts remembering like how to kick ass with her martial arts and everything. So basically what's going to happen in the show is every week they discover what a new tattoo means, and that tattoo is going to lead them to stop a different crime. And she also doesn't have her memory.
That's going to get awkward at some point.
Right, because aren't they going to run out of fucking tattoos if this goes like 100 episodes? So I thought there was going to be a broad overarching plot here. There is, but they've decided to background it in favor of the tattoos. Now, Greg Berlanti, who does The Arrow and The Flash, is an executive producer on this, which is part of the reason I was disappointed. But here's the interesting thing about this show that really made me think about TV writing and script writing a little bit more. Because if you look at our Facebook page at all, one of our followers, one of our fans, one of our supporters asked this week for a book to read about movies. And I linked her to the book called Save the Cat, which is basically about the 15 basic beats in every script and that need to be in there. And Save the Cat means you always start with something that establishes the hero is good. You start with the hero saving the cat. So that's what they did in this episode, right? They started with the hero being smart enough and clever enough to figure out how to save the captured wives. But here's the problem with that. It gave the show no significance, no thematic significance. That is a very naturalistic approach to say, oh, this guy did something good, therefore he's good. It's a very simplistic way of looking at it. And then there was one scene in the show that was better than the rest. And I think if they had started with this theme, or with the show, it would have given the show a theme, and it would have made it a lot stronger. So, after a commercial break, not that I watch it with commercials, but you can tell because there's a black space in between the scenes. The psychologist is talking with the woman, helping her cope with the fact that she can't remember anything. And he puts a coffee and a tea in front of her. And he's like, good morning, do you want coffee or tea? And she's like, well, I don't know if I like either. And he tells her to try it. And then he gives her a speech. And he says to her, we're defined by our choices. You just don't remember yours. So keep trying new things. See what your body remembers, or make new choices. The more you make, the less helpless you feel. Even if nothing ever comes back, you can still find yourself. And nothing ever coming back, he means his memories. Could you
so
give
she
a...
chose coffee?
She actually did choose coffee, I believe.
I'm watching it!
But the point is, it's twofold. One, could you give a better romantic speech? About a show about the importance of choice helping you know who you are. And then how is the show naturalistic off of that? Now imagine if that was the first scene in the show. A guy sitting across from a woman and asking her, do you want coffee or tea? And she says, well, I don't know if I like either. I don't remember. And then he gives her that speech. Wouldn't that be an incredibly compelling opening?
Yeah, not enough blues.
That sounds like the Greg Berlanti in that episode. Because I know he's probably the producer, but he probably didn't write the pilot, did he?
No, he didn't. You're right. I mean, that may be the Greg Berlanti influence on it.
Yeah, there is a Berlantian element to it.
But, Dan, it's exactly the point you just made, Daniel. There's not enough boom in it. And we'll see this when I talk about the player in 2 seconds here. Everything has to start with these gigantic fucking action sequences now. That's how we show... That's what Saving the Cat has become. I mean, look at the beginning of The Avengers, right? It's just the Avengers Age of Ultron. Wasn't it just them fighting?
Yeah.
Yep. Otherwise, Billy Bob in Bumfuck, Iowa won't be interested, right? Because these aren't thinking people. They have no interest in ideas or actual characterization or theme. All they want is boom, explosion, gunshot, bleh.
But they do. If you give it to them, they will respond to it.
I know.
And that's the thing that people don't understand is It's this elitist mentality that exists in the media where it doesn't matter if we tell the truth in journalism. It just matters if we get our point across, our agenda across. It's the same thing with movie making. They think people are too stupid to understand art. So they just make this stuff because they think they're pandering and they think they need to pander.
Indeed.
So I would give this a review of...
Yeah, I think I'll just stay here a while. Enjoy the sunrise.
It might do well. It might not. I don't know. But it's pretty typical for... Maybe it's a little better than NBC programming because it actually has sort of a unique premise. But if it goes on, I won't be watching it. All right. So let's move on to The Player here. This is a show I might actually give a little bit of a chance here. Now, that's not saying I'm going to rate it any higher. But the premise of this show is basically... There's a guy in Las Vegas who used to be Special Forces and is now a security expert. But he gets roped into playing for the house. And what I mean by that is there is an organization that can predict crime. And based on predicting crime, all the richest people in the world, who they never identify, bet on what's going to happen in the crime. But the house, who controls all the bets, has a player. And he is the main character is the player. And they bet against or for him, whether he's able to stop the crime or not. And that's the basic premise of the show.
All right. That's not entirely stupid.
It's not entirely stupid, but here's the thing about it. The show starts out a little slow, and it starts out slow in the sense that they're just showing this guy be a security expert. And he's protecting this family who are in Vegas, and he's protecting them to make, you know, he's testing their defenses. So you think it's just about being a security expert, and they slowly reveal the fact that they're trying to recruit him, Wesley Snipes and this woman are trying to recruit him into this organization. And Elliot, you'll appreciate this. In the middle of it, they tell him that, you know, they take him to a rooftop and they were like, you have 8 minutes to decide whether you want to stop the girl from being kidnapped because we know she's going to be kidnapped. And they're trying to convince him that it's possible to predict crime. And I just go, God damn it, this became Person of Interest.
No.
Because it's sort of similar in that way, where they, you know, they give him, they're probably going to, you know, it's going to be sort of procedural in that week, where they give him a different crime to stop every week, and he has to try and stop it, type deal. But the other thing about this show, which... I thought was very interesting, or interesting not from a made the show great, but interesting where it shows the difference between high quality programming and sort of average programming, is a scene from the beginning of the episode, which paid off later. So at the beginning of the episode, this guy is trying to figure out how to, you know, like I said, test the family's defenses to make sure they're safe. And the daughter of the family has a conversation with him, and she says, how do you do that? How do you figure out what bad guys are going to do? He says, think like a bad guy. And she says to him, how do you think like a bad guy without being a bad guy? To which I said, didn't Will Graham already address all of this? Wasn't this the entire point of Hannibal?
Yeah.
Doesn't that sound exactly like it, Daniel?
Yeah, it's basically what's going on.
Right. But isn't that, it's a really dumb way of saying that. Like, they demonstrated why Will Graham was able to think like a bad guy without being like a bad guy. And even within that, they showed the psychological issues it caused to him, which is what made Hannibal such an appealing and psychologically complex show. Whereas this show later on, the guy says to his ex-wife after or before he sleeps with her and before she's killed, he says to her that, oh, the daughter of this family is really smart because she asked me, how do you think like a bad guy without being like a bad guy? To which I was like, well, this is the worst thing about this show because it shows me how stupid it is. Because if somebody asked me that question, how do you think like a bad guy without being a bad guy? I would have two possible responses. Well, besides the Hannibal thing, that would be my first one. I would be like, have you ever seen Hannibal? Or my second response would be just to look at them like they're an idiot and walk away. And my third response would be, have you ever heard of a thought experiment?
Like, most people would say, I've never heard of a thought.
Well, that's my question. Are people so narcissistic that they're not able to put themselves in somebody else's position and say, what would I do if I were in that position?
Certainly not something we encourage anymore.
All right.
It's not a safe space, Justin.
All right. So ultimately, this show, I would say, is a combination of Hannibal, as I just said, because there's the whole question of this guy is trying to stop criminals by thinking like criminals, so he has to deal with the fact that is he good or bad, because one of the underlying sort of themes of the episode was, I used to be special forces and do bad things and kill bad people, therefore I was bad. So that whole thing, like Hannibal, meets person of interest with the whole predictive crime element, and there's a, you know, a sort of quirky, smart character played by Wesley Snipes who gives the mission in the same way Michael Emerson gives it to Jim Caviezel. And then also it's similar to Drive, the show that only ran for about 4 episodes on Fox, starring Nathan Fillion, where it was a road race. It was an underground illegal road race that nobody knew about, that people were drafted into, and a bunch of rich people were betting on it. Sort of like the movie Rat Race, if you've ever seen that. So that's what I would call this show, a combination of...
It's a race. I'm going to win.
Yeah, exactly. If only Wario was in it. Can we make a Wario movie or TV show? Somebody make that happen.
That wasn't a Wario reference. That was a Rat Race reference.
Oh, was it?
It was Mr. Bean.
Sounds like Mr. Bean was ripping off Wario to me.
It's a race. I'm going to win.
All right. So ultimately, I would give this show a...
Yeah. I think I'll just stay here a while. Enjoy the sunrise.
I'll probably watch a couple more episodes, though.
Although in a remake of the Super Mario Brothers real-life movie, Rowan Atkinson would not be a horrible choice for Wario.
If we put fat makeup on him.
Yeah, a la, you know, Mike Myers in The Spy Who Shagged Me, of course. But still, I kind of like that casting.
All right, make it happen, Hollywood. Let's move on to our final review of the week, though, and it's something you guys both watched.
Woo!
The Muppets. Give me your guys' impressions of the Muppets premiere.
Like of Kermit, or... I don't really do impressions. I don't know what you want me to.
Kermit the Frog here.
Kermit the Frog here.
Is that what you were setting up?
Yes. Thank you.
The only thing I could say as Kermit is Kermit the Frog here.
Yeah.
I'm up for sure.
So, okay.
Special guest.
Elliot, why don't you go first?
I actually liked it a lot. I think a lot of people were kind of put off by some of the more adult humor in it, but for those of us who remember the Muppets from, you know, our childhoods, we remember that the Muppets were not always, you know, kid-friendly. They had some blue humor to it. So it didn't put me off the way it put off a lot of other people.
Hey, blue humor is racist against Gonzo. You take that back.
And I think that it was, I actually enjoyed it a lot. I mean, I laughed so hard, the whole Tom Bergeron thing. You know, Scooter, you go into a studio full of dancing stars and you bring back Tom Bergeron? And then he's like, I'm not even in the elevator yet. And I just laughed so hard. I thought it was so funny. And then the golf cart with Elizabeth Banks, you know, where she and Scooter are just beating the hell out of each other. It was hysterically funny. And I enjoyed it. I thought it was really enjoyable. So I would rate it above average, if there's a rating for that.
No, there's only 3 ratings.
Alright. Fine, then I'll say it was...
This is blasphemy. This is madness!
Madness.
This is Sparta!
I didn't have quite as positive a reaction. I did enjoy some of the subtle humor. There was a little bit of sexual innuendo, which, I mean, there's always been sort of adultish humor in the Muppets, but I think adding a sexual innuendo portion there was a little risky, but I think it works fairly well. There was a lot of setup in this first episode, which is, I think, partially why I didn't enjoy it. I typically hate pilots in general because they are all too expositional. So I'm going to continue watching this. I think it has potential. I like the dynamic of Kermit being a little bit more confident and not pandering to Miss Piggy. I always maybe subconsciously had a problem with her just beating the fuck out of him in everything they ever did. Like, that just didn't fit right with me.
As a guy, you were subconsciously upset that a woman was beating a man.
Yeah, and maybe that's horribly sexist of me, somehow. I mean, someone will tell me it is. But
were you calling her a pig or something?
Yeah, it just never felt right. It was always like, what are you doing with her? Like, you could do so much better. So he's also with a pig now, but she's younger and prettier and brings him lattes.
Yeah, and she's actually nice to him? Yeah. I mean, who cares that she's younger and prettier? She's nice.
It was a big change. The only other thing I'll say that I was a little bit disappointed with was the jokes from the old men in the balcony. Now, it didn't really hit like they usually do.
But they had them in the show. I was happy they just included them. Like, one of the good things for me about the episode was they actually made an effort to include a bunch of smaller Muppets, and they didn't have to.
Like Rizzo, you know, you barely see Rizzo in the more recent movies. I was happy to see him, you know, in the bigger part here.
And they did a couple good Pepe the Prawn jokes.
Oh, yeah.
It's true. It's true. But alas, so I think I would rate this a...
Yeah. I think I'll just stay here a while. Enjoy the sunrise.
But I'm looking forward to it getting better, hopefully. Hopefully this was just pilot mediocrity.
I'm with you, Daniel. I would also rate it a...
Yeah. I think I'll just stay here a while. Enjoy the sunrise.
Speaking about sort of the character development, the one thing I'm concerned about is the development of Kermit and Miss Piggy. One of the things I really liked was what you said, was Kermit actually showing character growth and being different than the typical Kermit, but still being Kermit. And what I mean by that is Kermit sort of works as the Dave character from News Radio, where everyone around him is fucking nuts. And he's sort of the average, normal one going, how do I deal with all of this insanity? And it was good to see him finally show that confidence that he needs to make the Muppet Show work, to make, you know, working with Miss Piggy work, and actually be confident, unlike how he's dealt with her before. And what I worry about with the show is the whole thing being about them finding their love again, and him going back to the way he was because he realizes he loved her. He loves her. Because they set that up at the beginning where he was like, you know, when I was with her, the way she acted was just sort of cute and quirky. But now it's annoying, basically. Well, does that mean if he goes back to loving her again, that he's going to go back to thinking it's quirky again? So it's just going to basically reset all of this? Because...
Sacrifice.
Right.
I don't think so. I think that the setup... that I saw anyway is more about her modulating for it. I think it's Miss Piggy who's going to go through the arc, not necessarily Kermit.
Well, if they do, the problem with a show like this and with characters like this is, can you do an arc? And that's my basic question, is when you have the Muppets who are such static characters, right? In everything the Muppets have ever done, they've been the same. And then you're going to put them in this overarching show, and traditionally sitcoms, especially by Bill Prady, who's executive producer here, don't have really arcs. I mean, think of how the Big Bang characters haven't really changed all that much. Even Sheldon, they've worked really hard not to change. Can you change these characters? That's what I want to know. Because you need to, especially with this premise that's been set up. It's a great way of approaching the show. But can you change these characters?
Yeah, to be seen, I think, to be optimistic about it, if Elliot's right and Miss Piggy is the one who goes through the character change, that would be a fantastic statement. That would be so unbelievably good for television.
In fact, if you track like the movies, you know, from The Muppets with Jason Segel to Muppets Most Wanted, the more recent ones, this has been kind of building up to the show, because one of the recurring themes that's been coming up is Piggy's love of fame and love of stardom. And at times that, in fact, most of the time it seems to supersede her love of Kermit. So now you have her on the show in a position where she has that stardom, she has that fame, and she no longer has Kermit, you know, to kind of compete with that. So now I think we're going to start seeing if that's, you know, is this really what she wants, or is it incomplete without Kermit? What does this mean for her? Is she going to, what changes is she going to have to make within herself?
But even in the episode, I would argue that the payoff to the episode had nothing to do with Piggy having a realization. It was Kermit learning to be emotionally sensitive to her. And what I mean by that is the basic premise of the episode was Elizabeth Banks was going to be her guest on her talk show, and she didn't want to have Elizabeth Banks on, and Kermit was basically saying, you're being irrational, stop it. When it turned out that Kermit thought she was being irrational because she had a bad screen test for The Hunger Games with Elizabeth Banks,
by the way,
really she was...
That was the funniest scene.
Yeah, it was very funny. Even though it was sort of an obvious joke, it was funny because
still.
Elizabeth Banks actually is in the Hunger Games, and the best part was when she was like, I already have the part, right? I don't have to be here.
Go ahead.
So Kermit thought that's why Piggy was being irrational, but the reason she was being irrational was she was in a movie they were going to see on the night they broke up. In reality, Piggy had no fucking reason to be mad at Elizabeth Banks. That's fucking stupid emotionalist association. But at the end, Kermit apologized for not being sensitive to her. And I don't think that's a good sign. I think basically what's going to happen is you're going to find out over the series that the reason Piggy acts the way she does is she's being defensive because no one takes her emotional needs into account. And Kermit never did that. And as Kermit learns to take her emotional needs into account, he just gets stepped on over and over again. That's what I think is going to happen.
That's what I think is going to happen. I want to be optimistic with Elliot.
Yeah, I'm optimistic in that. I think that at the very least, they're both going to go through an arc. I don't think that it's going to be all on Kermit.
So we'll see. Also, by the way, listeners, no one on the entire internet has analyzed the Muppets this much.
This is true.
So anyone you know who loves the Muppets and loves intellectualism, go ahead and send them this episode. It'd be a good thing for them.
Well, it's the big show this season so far because, as we saw with a bunch of these stories, the Netflix apocalypse is upon us, and the media is pushing this story this week because all the fall TV ratings are disappointing except The Muppets. That's the only show that's really sort of performed at a level where anyone's ever expected anything and expected any sort of positivity, and they got that. So that's sort of why we're treating The Muppets that seriously. It's also partially because we grew up with The Muppets and you guys watched that and I'm the only ones who watched the other two shows. But they're blaming Netflix. The media is blaming Netflix for this. And that's a question I want to ask you guys. Is this just an agenda by the media, or is Netflix really to blame, or is there more going on here? Because a couple of the other stories that came out, we have the FX cheap John Landgraf saying that all of FX's shows are better than Netflix's programming. And he also points out on it, you laugh, Elliot, but I actually think he has a point.
He does not.
Let's see, FX, they have what?
Hold like, on, I'm not finished.
Let me finish. Can I finish?
Story, okay?
Can I finish?
I gotta do the outline here. And one of the things he points out is that Netflix actually only has like 14 series. They're very new in their programming. And then finally, another story that came out this week was that Netflix has finally revealed data of when viewers commit to TV shows. And I think this article actually will help focus our discussion a little bit, where it says it basically takes about 3 to 4 episodes for people to get into a show, which is what I've found. Is usually I have to give a show 3 episodes before if it's decent, I have to give it 3 before I decide I want to commit to it long term. You know, if it's like Blind Spot, I might watch 1 and say I'm done with it. But I'll probably give The Player 3 episodes now. So I think that reveals more about why the ratings are down than blaming it on Netflix. But continue with what you wanted to say about Netflix being better than FX.
Go ahead, Elliot.
But I'm just mocking that, oh, FX's shows are better than Netflix. I'm like, okay, let's see. FX has maybe 2 good shows, Archer and It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. And even then, they can be spotty. But
Sons of Anarchy was one of the biggest shows ever on television. People don't realize that.
Biggest doesn't mean good. Sorry. And I was not a fan. I was
not a fan of it either, but it was romantic. You have to give Kurt Suter credit. You know, it eventually devolved into Christianity as the answer to what's wrong with humanity. But it was romantic. It was portraying a theme of how anarchy leads to the worst in humanity coming out and leading to violence and death and destruction.
And I do want to give, you know, FX full credit. There are other shows in there I think are good, like The League, I think is consistently good.
Mm-hmm.
I've never watched Justified, but people say that that's good. Mm-hmm. And then The Strain, which I didn't particularly get into, people seem to enjoy.
I love The Strain. It's a Carlton Cuse show.
American
also,
Horror Story.
Yeah, that's huge, although now, it's that fucking guy I hate. And also I want to name drop here Man Seeking Woman on FXX. Very good show, very hilarious show, starring Jay Baruchel.
But the one show that I'm going to really fucking hit them over that is so unbelievably overrated, that it makes me want to hate them as a network is Louis. Incredibly overrated.
Yeah, but that's because that's not their fault. That's people overhype Louis C.K. himself.
Oh, just because, I mean, it's a thing where you can give him props for doing most of the show himself, filming, editing, etc. That takes a lot of talent. But that being said, a 9-year-old can also film their own show and edit it and put it on the internet. Doesn't make it good.
Yeah,
I don't think
YouTube?
Louis is good. I think it's piss poor, in fact. Way fucking overrated. So, anyway, continue with whatever you're doing.
Well, the point is Netflix the cause of these ratings disappointments? Or is there something else going on that's causing the decline in network television?
It's an on-demand society. People want to watch the shows when it fits in their schedule. You know, they like being able to binge watch. You know, you can spend a weekend, you know, a 3-day weekend, you can binge watch your favorite shows and you can, or discover a new show. That's really what it comes down to. It's just customization. Everything, it's boutique entertainment. It's all for you at your leisure, at your time. You don't have to wait a week between episodes. You know how awesome it is to be able to binge watch like seasons of Arrow or The Flash and not necessarily have to wait week to week for
it? Well, yes, I do actually, having watched 3 seasons of The Arrow and now almost halfway through the first season of The Flash. But I think that's why the media is pushing this idea that it's Netflix that's doing this. But I don't think it's Netflix. I think it's the amount of content that's out there, as we've talked about before. I think the networks haven't stepped their game up because they're using the old traditional save the cat method, to give a shorthand, rather than try and increase the quality on network television when the cable channels are out there, and yes, some on-demand providers are out there trying to make new, different content.
So in the course of this discussion, I have changed my mind.
That's what we like to see here in the Midside.
I think FX is right. I think their shows on the whole are better than the Netflix series. So,
this is the challenge, right? Now, I have not seen Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, but of the 14, and you know, there are going to have more because aka Jessica Jones is coming out, and there's another one that's coming out, forget. But can you name 4 good shows on Netflix?
So here are the good shows on Netflix for me. Daredevil.
Daredevil. Okay, that's the one I can name.
Seasons of House of Cards I thought were very good.
House of Cards.
The third one, that show you were talking about, Justin.
Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt?
No, before, I can't remember the name of it. But I mean, that was supposed to be a very good one.
I think Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt was good. Marco Polo was good, but...
I heard it was awful.
It was not awful. It was slow. It was maybe about one tick faster than Mad Men, which is the only reason I could stay with it.
Marco Polo to me seemed like a bad version of Da Vinci's Demons.
Very different. Very different kind of show. Marco Polo is much more like Mad Men than it is Da Vinci's Demons. But, if you look at the other shows on Netflix, first of all, while Louis fucking sucks, we can go ahead and cancel Louis out with Orange is the New Black. And for all of you people out there who like Orange is the New Black, okay, but you're wrong.
I'm not even gonna say okay. If you like Orange is the New Black, you are just fucking following the trend. Alright?
That's gonna insult most of the audience. But,
I'm gonna insult most of the audience. Orange is the New Black is an awful fucking show, alright? I might even go as far as to say it's an evil show.
It may be. So let's cancel out Louis with Orange is the New Black, so those cancel each other out, and those are... But you have House of Cards, Daredevil, which you talked about. The other season of Arrested Development was shit. Grace and Frankie is horrifying. Bloodline, I haven't watched. People, I guess, seem to like it. Marco Polo is okay. Bo Jackman, what the hell is that? The Killing sucks. The Return sucks. Hemlock Grove is awful.
Oh, the bringing back The Killing wasn't good? Because the first couple seasons of The Killing were good on AMC.
No, sucks. Lillehammer blows. Trailer Park Boys, I don't know what that is.
Trailer Park Boys is an absurd show that was on when we were in undergrad and they brought back on Netflix.
Yeah. So I think FX is right. Their shows in general are better. Now, you have to take into account here that Netflix and the rise of streaming things, is the proliferation of content is going to cut into new shows but not because of other new shows, but because you can watch basically anything you want on Amazon or Netflix. And sometimes you're going to prioritize older shows above new shows.
Right. And I think the thing that needs to be recognized here is Netflix and its original content is still very new. So if we're going to be blaming the fallen ratings on Netflix, I think it's misplaced. I think it's what Elliot said. It's, you know, it's available. There's, you know, you can stream stuff whenever you want on all sorts of different programming. And it's what I said. There's so much content available everywhere. If anything, it's the cable networks who are challenging the network television with all their quality programming. And here's the last thing I'm going to say about this. I think somebody who needs to be recognized for trying harder to make better original content, not that they're necessarily succeeding, but I think Amazon has a better model for creating better original content, better new content than Netflix does. Because Netflix just tries to read what people are watching on Netflix and create something to cater to that. They're not trying to make a good new show. Whereas Amazon, while they're basically just throwing shit at a wall and seeing what sticks, is at least trying to create new original content.
Yeah, agreed.
The key thing here, though, is the customization of it. I mean, if for the same reason why taxi companies get upset with Uber, you know, because Uber allows people to kind of take control over their own transportation, and they don't have to worry about having to pay outrageous fees for a taxi driver that, you know, is just probably not going to be very good. Same thing, I think, in this respect. People are able to go to Netflix and they can customize their own viewing schedule, watch the shows either that they love or discover shows that they can take a chance on that are not going to be interrupted with commercials, that are not going to have be scrubbed clean by the FCC, that are going to be able to have at least a little bit of rawness and a little bit of edginess to them, which is a big factor, I think, in entertainment, whether people want to admit it or not. And I think that's why the networks are starting to suffer. There are too many cooks in the kitchen when it comes to a network program. So I think people kind of want unfiltered original content coming through so that they can actually watch it and enjoy it or not enjoy it.
Yeah, but the point I'm making is, not that any of that's incorrect, all of that is correct, but the point I'm making is, the word Netflix here is a media agenda. Trying to push Netflix, and it's great for Netflix, it's great marketing for Netflix, as if Netflix is the only one doing this. What about Amazon? What about Hulu? I mean, how much of the market does Hulu have? Nobody ever fucking talks about Hulu and their original shows and how everyone streams on Hulu.
Or, as the social media guy in the room raises his hand, fucking YouTube. How much time do people spend on YouTube? Especially young people. Young people spend an incredible amount of time on YouTube.
I mean, the new media stars on YouTube, the money they're making, things like epic rap battles, and we know how the Guild made all their money, made Felicia Day's career. So,
PewDiePie, the number one rated YouTube star in the world, with 33 million subscribers, blows away the networks every single video he makes.
Blows away Netflix, doesn't it?
Maybe not Netflix in aggregate, but per piece of content, certainly. He has an unbelievable viewership and amount of time people spend watching him. But just in general, YouTube as a channel for content, especially for young people, certainly millennials, but even slightly younger than what we would consider millennial age, spend just an inordinate amount of time on that network.
You know what millennials spend an inordinate amount of time on?
Porn.
Porn and Reddit, which they probably find on Reddit. Now let's talk about what we found on Reddit in Reddit on Reddit.
Sony stupid, Xbox lame, PC gaming all the way, EA blows, Steam rocks, got Respawn on Firefox. These things are all on Reddit, mostly pics of felines, comma boring felines. These things are all on Reddit, no we didn't post it, but we will repost it.
First, Reddit. And this is going to be an interesting question because of the way it's phrased. What should everyone do without being asked? Now, this is interesting because it's the word should, right? And we can easily very slide into behavior of saying the government should mandate this. But that's why it's an interesting question to me, because it's do without being asked.
I have a really general answer. and maybe this is maybe bleeding into Justin territory in terms of
don't take my answer.
The kind of, I don't know what your answer is. We don't pregame. So, my really general answer is be aware of other fucking people around you.
That was
and
my
I think,
answer.
Oh. Well, there you go. Because I think a lot of the answers provided here are things like that. You know, one of the things that user Tapangato points out is something that pisses me off on a daily basis on the metro, which is when the train is full and people have their briefcase or their backpacks on the seat next to them. And there are maybe 25 or 30 people standing, all staring at this guy, and he's just got the backpack there just reading his book.
And does anyone ever ask him and he gets mad that they
yes.
ask?
This is a completely racial statement, not racist, but racial. 100% of the people who ask are black. 100%. I've never seen a white person ask someone to move the book bag. Now, I'm not saying this is a negative thing. This is completely
good
prescriptive.
Old black people, yeah.
They are way more assertive, and that is a fantastic thing, because all I do is stand there and look like a fucking idiot, staring at the backpack, looking at him, backpack him, backpack him, just hoping he'll see, and he never does.
That's but, because they've got you scared because of your whiteness.
Yes. I don't want it to seem like I have privilege.
That's white guilt.
That
it
seat.
Is. It's white guilt.
But a black man or, my God, certainly a black woman will go up and be like, excuse me, can you move this? Thank you. As they begin to sit down on the backpack.
You know what? But, I've noticed that in my life. And you know what? I actually respect them for doing that. When they
yeah.
do that. Like, usually black women will be like, can you move that? And I'll be like, oh, sure thing. And then we become friends in a moment.
Yes, indeed.
Because
so,
I mean, they probably appreciate that I'm nice to them about it. You know what I mean? Like, you don't have to be a dick if some... I mean, it goes both ways, the thing you're saying. Like, you know, don't leave the bag there. But then again, if someone has the balls to ask you to move the bag, like, don't be a dick about it. Don't be like, oh, sure, I'll move the bag. Just be like, oh, sure thing, you can sit.
Yeah. But that goes with my sort of general statement, which is just be generally aware of other human beings in your vicinity. The sort of corollary to that is people who wear their backpack on the metro. And then when you're standing there, you know, they take a step back, but they don't fucking think that I have a giant thing on my back, and they knock your phone out of your hand, which has never happened to me, but it has happened to other people.
Yeah, or they turn.
Oh, the turning. You know how many people get hit in the fucking head every day?
Yeah.
Like, turning backpacks and bags? It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
So anyway, be aware of human beings. Thank you.
Elliot?
I'd be happy if people just showered. Now, listen, when you work at the theme park... When you work in a theme park, you can tell, usually around the 1 o'clock, you know, hour, you can tell when somebody showered that morning and when they didn't. Cause even though everybody's got a little whiff coming off of them, there's always those people that just, you know, they rolled out of bed and strolled right through the front gate and did not even bother to shower or towel off or anything. So I cannot believe that I have to say this, but people, shower.
Yeah, good advice. Justin?
Well, mine's similar to yours. I mean, I was gonna give that exact answer, but it's kinda tough for me because I've learned a little bit of a lesson, if you saw my Facebook post recently, from an experience I had about sort of, you know, one of the things I always complain about in this vein is driving. You know, everyone's not aware of the other people on the road. But I think it's the same thing with the subway, Daniel, the metro, is we're talking about these things where everyone is on there. There's no filter. Anyone can get on the metro. Anyone can, well, I mean, there's a little bit of a filter in the sense that not everyone can get a car. But we're living in a society where it's pretty much, you know, everyone can get a car, everyone can get a license. So when you're on the road, or when you're on the metro, or when you're anywhere out in public, it's everyone. From, you know, genius McGenius to stupid McStupid. And they're all interacting.
Why is everyone Irish?
Because I was trying to, because I'm Italian and I hate the Irish, okay?
Thank you.
So when you're out, you kind of have to take into account that you're just dealing with people who don't know how to cope with things, who aren't very smart. Now, what I'm saying is that doesn't excuse them. So I guess the suppressed premise to what you're saying, Daniel, is I think what everyone should do without being asked is fucking educate yourself and have pride in yourself. No one should have to say to you, love yourself. No one should have to say to you, care about yourself, have self-esteem. But it seems like in today's day and age, we have to tell people, you know, oh, you have to learn that. You have to take care of yourself. And this probably goes to the whole, you know, government coddling people and treating them like children. But all these things these people are doing are detriments to themselves as well. And that's what they don't realize. And that's what pisses me off the most. So I think to go a bit deeper than you did, Daniel, is no one should have to be told to take care of themselves, to love themselves, and to educate themselves, which would be a cognate of taking care of yourself and loving yourself.
Yeah. That's a good point.
All right. Next Reddit. What movie do you hate that was critically acclaimed?
All of them. I used to hate basically every movie that came out. Now I know why. I was seeing the wrong movies.
Yeah, because you didn't know about Zack Snyder.
It's true.
Which, by the way, that was a point I wanted to make earlier that I didn't make when we were talking about the opening of movies. So I think to contrast how you can do a good opening action sequence versus, you know, how Age of Ultron did it, look at the opening of Man of Steel. One of the things that hooked me on Man of Steel immediately was it didn't jump immediately into the action, but it was immediately intense, and I knew thematically what was going on. The way they portrayed Jor-El versus the Council on Krypton showed me the basic conflict of the movie and gave significance to that opening action sequence. It wasn't just Jor-El running away from the police. There was a reason he was doing it, and there was something he was fighting for. And I don't just mean he was fighting for his son. I mean there were ideas he was fighting for. There was a why he was fighting, and that was done with the opening scene.
It's a good one. It's a good opening scene. So my original answer for this was Avatar, but I decided that Avatar was also fairly panned in terms of plotting and structure and unobtainium. And so I decided to change my answer because I suddenly became filled with rage as I remembered the ultimate to me of this nonsense, which was Black Fucking Swan.
Yeah, that's a good one.
I almost walked out of the theater. It's the only movie I've ever almost walked out of. The only reason I didn't is because I was with a friend and I would have had to go wait by myself somewhere, which was annoying to me. But I still to this day cannot fathom what people saw in that movie. It's poorly directed. It's poorly written. It's poorly acted. The characters are dumb. It's naturalistic. It's visually horrifying. It is an entire package of shit that the critics could not stop circle jerking over. It was ridiculous.
Yeah, very few movies actually give me a negative emotional reaction. Black Swan made me sick to my stomach when I saw it.
Yes.
I haven't seen it, actually.
Just, I wouldn't even tell you don't. I would say, don't fucking watch it. That's what I would say. Like, literally watch any other movie you've never watched, except Black Swan.
When you see movies like All About Eve and Single White Female, it just kind of seemed like a hybrid of the two. So it never really piqued my interest, you know.
Also, here, I'll keep you away from it. There's a hardcore lesbian scene. Now you'll never see it.
I'll never see it.
It is with Mila Kunis, though.
Who is attractive, but in this movie, hated this movie. Elliot?
Crash. I hate that movie. I hate it with a passion, with the burning heat of a thousand suns. I remember watching it, and all these people just saying these horrible, stupid, racist things to each other. And I remember thinking to myself, this is not life. This is not how people talk to each other. And I read somewhere, I can't remember where I read, I think it was Robert McKee. He was talking about California scenes in movies where people just kind of walk up to each other and just start divulging all of their deep-seated emotional, you know, issues to a perfect stranger. And he called them California scenes because apparently there's a subset of people in California that's what they do. And that's what I thought of when I watched this movie. Like, maybe they talk like this in L.A. and they think that everybody else in the world or at least in the United States of America talks like this. But, I mean, just watching that movie, it was not my sense of life at all. It just wasn't. I walked out of that theater just being utterly disgusted by it. And the fact that it beat out Brokeback Mountain for the Oscar that year just made it even worse.
Yay.
Totally.
Your pink shoes and your cucumber melon deodorant.
Fresh salad armpits.
Oh, God.
At least it's better than tossed salad armpits.
That's a band name right there. Fresh Salad Armpit. I don't know.
Yeah. All right, Justin?
Well, there's always, you know, you can say Mad Max Fury Road because that came out this year, but I wouldn't say I hate that. I just think it's really overrated. I would say the most recent example I can give is Birdman. That movie is vile. Mm-hmm. They shot the whole thing to make it look like one shot because that's more representative of real life. And just all the characters are just awful, awful human beings. It literally ends with the predictable, oh, he's going to kill himself plot, which, you know, I would argue naturalism sort of always has to end with, which, you know, Black Swan has that as well, right? The whole death at the end of it. So,
yeah.
Birdman, just awful, awful movie. I kept waiting for it to do anything, and it didn't.
Yeah, it was like the trumped-up version of Boyhood.
Yeah, right. Which, honestly, Boyhood probably would have won the Oscar if it didn't come out in the year of Birdman. Birdman was just an attack on superhero movies. It was, you know, how do we do a superhero movie naturalistically, and that's how they did it, and that's why it won, because people hate the romanticism in the superhero genre.
Yeah, the Academy can go suck itself off. It's ridiculous.
Yay. All right, last Reddit. What's the most fucked up thing your SO, not superior officer, significant other, they keep doing this on Reddit, they keep saying SO, or XSO has done to you? No. Now, I'm not going to lie, I included this as kind of a cathartic thing. Also, I want to see how Daniel gets out of this.
Oh, boy.
I had to think long and hard about this answer. I'll give my answer, which is that Fives hasn't particularly done anything super fucked up or maniacal to me, but there is one thing that drives me insane, and it's embarrassing, and I can't get her to stop. We've talked about it, and it's just like, in the moment, she
building
never thinks
bombs.
About it. Yeah, you know, bombing trade centers and whatnot. But no. So, anytime we're in a professional, so anyone who knows my fiance knows that she basically has zero social filter. There is no setting on her of professional environment, or perhaps not the right context to say, go fuck your grandmother, or something like that.
Or okay? Just do stuff in, right? Like, doesn't modulate her behavior based upon environment either.
Correct. It is, there's just one setting. That's it.
Which is endearing in a way, because you're like, I appreciate the fact that you're just you.
100%. 100%. Which is why I love her deeply. But
notice how I'm helping you here.
So there have been two times, like, in professional settings where I've just been, I shouldn't be embarrassed. It's probably more on me than it is on her, but it's things like we had just moved. I forget if it was to LA, I think, and we were in a professional setting and someone asked her what she does and she didn't have a job yet. So I said, well, what do you do? And she said, right now, just my boyfriend. That's it.
Yeah, but that's funny.
Like, but it's to like a client who is not a funny client. And the client was taken aback. And then the other was recently when, she was asked if she was on staff at the place where I work. And she said, no, I'm on Daniel's personal staff. And it was,
See, that's funny because it's a double entendre.
Yes. Except again, the people I work with, many of them do not get humor. Certainly the people we work for have basically zero sense of humor. I know, I generally think that, but in the moment, it's like cringeworthy to me. And again, maybe my own psychology is more revealed here than anything bad she has done, but that's probably it. It's just, you know, sometimes I wish she had a 9 instead of an 11 on her personality, but anyway.
Every time you talk about her, I want to meet her even more. But she's probably like my favorite person that we have not had on the show that gets talked about a lot.
She's great. I love her. Don't get me wrong. It's just, whoa. Hey,
I'm
there.
Not racist, but that's what that just sounded like.
I think Fives and I would be like best friends forever.
Yeah, probably. You just have to have unbelievable self-esteem. Like, that's, she is like a, you know, the shark can smell a drop of blood in a water from like 2 miles away or something. She's like that with people with low self-esteem. It's just like, she will find the area and just destroy you. So.
Elliot?
Yeah. Oh, gosh. I did have, I guess, the worst thing that I think an ex has ever done. I dated a guy who, he was Jewish. He threw a party for Passover. And a lot of people who, you know, Jewish and non-Jewish, and did not invite me.
Heathen.
Oh.
Right. So.
Wow.
Yeah, so that was kind of the first indication that, maybe he's not as into me as I was hoping he would be. And, yeah, we didn't last too much longer after that. So, yeah.
Oy vey.
Yeah, well, it's one of those things, you know, he would say, oh, I'm busy. I can't, you know, we can't go out because I'm busy. And then he would post photos of himself on Facebook hanging out at like the theme parks. Or walking around the mall or something, or, and like, well, I thought you were busy with, you know, your college work, but whatever.
Backup plan. Sorry, dude, that happens. You were a backup plan.
So I was just like, you know, it just didn't work out very well.
That's so fucked up. Like, the fact that people have such low self-esteem that they can't just be like honest and be like, hey, you know, I want to hang out with you sometimes, but not that often. So I'll let you know when I'm free type deal. Like, if somebody wants to hang out and you just say, hey, I don't want to hang out right now. Like, what's wrong with saying that? There's nothing.
Yeah, people don't like disappointing. They don't like being the one who disappoints either. It's, that's particularly shitty, I think. Take that fucking hat on his head and throw it at him. Say, get out.
The yarmulke?
That thing.
Oh, yes. My God.
Yeah, gnomica, get the fuck out.
Guernica, what?
Mm-hmm. Yahweh, no way. Anyway, Justin? Do we have time? I mean,
well,
I was gonna say, like, wait a minute, this might be a special feature.
We shall now enter the next 2 hours of the podcast.
Well, I'll simplify it. And I think the best way to simplify it is to say, to lie and manipulate and try to convince me that I'm the one who is lying and manipulating. That sort of perversion of reality, it just messed with my head, and it can only mess with other people's heads, because something I had never encountered before, and I still to this day cannot wrap my head around, is somebody who is seemingly so convinced that she isn't the one lying and manipulating. You know, usually when people are lying and manipulating, I can read them very well and I can tell, because there's some level of self-awareness that creates a tell.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never encountered someone who is so convinced of what he or she is saying that he or she is hard to read. I don't even know how to comprehend that. How can you be so disconnected from reality? Because the only thing you can do is, you know, when you're interacting with that person is start, if they're so convinced, you have to start questioning, why are they so convinced? Is there something I'm missing?
Yeah, that particularly is a horrific thing to deal with in a relationship. The only thing that could possibly be done is to evaluate, you know, just, you know, absolutely say something like, is there something that I'm missing? And be thorough and evaluate, and then if you decide there's not, then you kick the bitch to the curb.
Well, right. And that was sort of the point I got to eventually, where I would literally say, like, and this was one of the most frustrating things for me, because I have a master's degree in professional communication. And now that sort of means business and tech writing. But to me, that also means being a professional at communicating. And I take that seriously on an interpersonal level as well. So it got to the point that things would be said, and then I would literally say, I don't understand. Could you please explain it to me? Or I would say, there is something I'm missing. This does not make sense to me. Which would only arise, what type of reaction do you think?
No, doubling down on the horror show that is the anti-realityness.
Right, anger. Anger at me for saying, I don't understand. But if I'm having a conversation with you, and I take the time to say I don't understand, that represents me valuing you. Because if somebody on my daily basis comes up to me and says something that I don't understand and doesn't make sense to me, what do you think I do to them?
You want to know. You ask some questions.
Well, that's if I value them. I'm saying if I don't value them. So
oh.
If some random person comes up to me and says something I don't understand and I can't comprehend, what do you think I do?
Well, you're from Boston, so it's either punch them in the face or walk away.
Yeah, usually I just walk away. Like, they talk, and I just look. Like I said with the story of the girl in the player. If she said to me, how do you think like a bad guy without being like a bad guy? That's something that doesn't make sense to me. I would just go, I don't understand that logic. Like, that's what I say. Have you ever heard of a thought experiment? But what I would really do is look at them and go, okay, you're not worth ever talking to again, and walk away. So the fact, you know, it's not only the lying and manipulating, but it's the anger at me for trying to deal with it and get through it.
Yeah.
All right.
Alas.
Alas. Alas. What did we learn this week? Elliot?
I learned that Wesleyan University apparently is their news, campus newspaper is whiter than, snow.
Yeah, pretty white. Although, you know, you're at Wesleyan. What do you want?
That's true.
And you have a minority paper, so shut up.
Daniel?
I learned that FX has a pretty killer lineup of shows. Certainly better than Netflix. Would not have guessed that. I don't watch enough network television.
Because you bought into the media storyline about Netflix.
I haven't had cable in going on almost 10 years. Like, I don't flip through and watch FX. Like when you ask me things like, have you seen the new ABC show or whatever? I don't even know what shows are on ABC. I just know shows.
Yeah, I pay attention to the network because that tells a little bit about the show, because they tend to, you know, have the same sort of personalities. Like, you know what a CBS show is going to be like.
Yeah, I judge by the show. So
that's so individualistic, Daniel.
What did you learn this week?
I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of things. It's tough. I mean, I'm inclined to say things that happened outside of the podcast where, I mean, we talked about it with the first Reddit, but just the idea of not to have more patience and more tolerance for people out in public and on the road, but it's just sort of realizing that it's a hodgepodge of everyone on the road. So of course there's going to be a lot of really bad drivers, and not to take it as people being malicious, because that's how I usually take it. But I think the maliciousness comes from the assumption of intentionality, which comes from the assumption of intelligence, when I think it's really just people who, and I don't necessarily want to say stupid, but, you know, they're not aware of other people, or they don't know what they're doing, so it's causing them to be poor drivers. I would think in 99% of the cases, that's the issue. And that's the same thing as being in theme parks or being in any other sort of place where there's a lot of people.
Yeah, indeed. Speaking of a lot of people, we need a lot of people to make this show a success, and we can only do that if you, the loyal listener, tell other people about us. Tell your friends and your coworkers and your boss and the annoying guy in the subway with the backpack. Be like, did you listen to the Midside of the podcast this week? Move that fucking backpack. And, yeah. So tell your friends about us. Go to iTunes. Give us a 5-star rating. We have so many 5-star ratings. It's unbelievable. People like us. They really like us, Justin. Elliot. And then there's facebook.com/midside.
They don't like me.
Oh, listen to that self-esteem bullshit.
That wasn't self-esteem. That was posturing so I can get away with saying my bullshit. It's like how Bill Burr is always like, I don't know, I'm not an expert. And then he says something like he's an expert. It's ethos building, Daniel.
Alas, twitter.com/themidside. And then, of course, we have those fantastic above the stratospherically great fans. I don't know how to say that. I was looking for some superlative that I couldn't come up with. Who go to Patreon.
Use the superlative William Green because of how much he pledged this week. I don't know if you guys saw.
I didn't. Fantastic.
He pledged $5 an episode.
William, Thank you very much. If you go to patreon.com/themidside, you can choose to give as little or as much as you want per episode. We'll take a penny or $1 million. It's fine. I know it'll be a little bit difficult on our side to process that money, but we'd be perfectly fine taking $1 million per episode. Whatever you want, penny per episode. That would be great too. It'd be phenomenal. It helps us defray the costs, helps us give you more content. Man, if we could make this thing independent, we could go daily. Just saying. Could go daily.
Maybe two times a day.
Maybe we'll just stream 24 hours a day, Midside commentary.
All right, that's pushing it.
Sort of like Fox News.
We could do once a day. Twice a day is pushing it. Streaming it is pushing it.
Just saying.
Get that Rush Limbaugh money. Just that's your job.
Guys, you're supposed to under-promise, over-deliver, not over-promise, under-deliver.
Duh, no wonder I failed out of that MBA. Anyway, so thanks for listening, and tell your friends we love you. Bye.
I'm Justin M. Lesneski, and I hope you learned something this week. This concludes your journey into the Midside. Good luck out there, and remember, if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a day!
We are recording. Welcome to the Midside, where the only white hat any of us wears celebrates our true love and...
our true love.
Wow.
Well.
That was our slip.
Well. Okay.
Freud.
Fuck Freud. All right. Like, part of the way through that, too, I was like, wow, I'm delivering this so well for 7:30 in the morning.
Also a great t-shirt for the Midside, by the way. Fuck Freud. Fuck Freud and Schrodinger's privilege.